Peace be upon you. So Richard Feynman was a Nobel laureate and one of the brightest minds in science. He contributed to particle physics. He was part of the Manhattan Project. And he also was the individual who's responsible for figuring out what happened with the Challenger disaster. But what set Feynman apart from other great scientists was his unique ability to be able to explain abstract concepts in a way that any listener could understand. And to articulate this point, I have this clip from him where he's talking about an experience he had when he was a child. So let's listen to that.
One Sunday, all the kids were all walking in little parties with their fathers in the woods. Then the next Monday, we were playing in a field. And the kid said to me, "Say, what's that bird? What's the name of it? Do you know the name of that bird?" I said, "I have the slightest idea." He said, "Well, it's a brown-throated thrush." He says, "Your father doesn't teach you anything." But my father had already taught me about the names of birds. We walked and he says, "That's a brown-throated thrush." He says, "Know what the name of that bird is? A brown-throated thrush. In German, it's called a Fliegenflügel. In Chinese, it's called a Qinglongtong. In Japanese, a Tohatohara. And so on." And when you know all the names in every language of that bird, you know nothing, but absolutely nothing about the bird. Then we would go on and talk about the pecking and the feathers. So I had learned already that names don't constitute knowledge. It's knowing the name of something.
Now, the reason I wanted to share this clip from Feynman is because it highlights a common misunderstanding among people, where many people often think they understand something just because they memorized the terms. Except knowing the name of something does not necessarily imply that they understand the concept that it represents. And I see this also reflected in the Quran, because the Quran often, it omits specific terms and names, thereby directing the reader's focus towards the heart of the message rather than the superficial details. So if you read like these history in the Quran, you'll see that oftentimes the Quran does not give the names of these individuals. It doesn't tell us what the name of Pharaoh was, what the name of his wife was, what the sons of Adam's names were, what the names of Joseph's brothers were, or the sleepers of the cave. Even if you read the story of the sleepers of the cave, in chapter 18, verse 22, it reads, "Some would say that they were three, their dog being the fourth, while others would say five, and the sixth being their dog. As they guessed, others said seven, and the eighth was their dog. Say, my Lord is the best knower of their number. Only a few knew the correct number. Therefore, do not argue with them, just go along with them. You need not consult anyone about this." So God is saying that he intentionally is not telling us exactly how many sleepers there were, which number was the dog. But then in addition, he says, look, a few know the correct number, but don't argue with them, just go along with them. You need not consult anyone about this, meaning that this information is not relevant to the significance of the story for why it's being cited. But you see people, they get fixated on that. They want to know that detail because it gives them a sense of superiority that, hey, they're on the inside. They have knowledge that other people don't. You know, the absence of specific names in the Quran or certain pieces of information that God did not find pertinent for our salvation implies that these names are not essential to understanding or the moral takeaway that we're supposed to have. If the names were critical to the lesson, they would have been mentioned explicitly. Therefore, their omission of names indicates that the focus should be on the lesson rather than these individual details. So in Surah 5, verse 101, we read, "O you who believe, do not ask about matters which, if revealed to you prematurely, would hurt you. If you ask about them in the light of the Quran, they will become obvious to you. God has deliberately overlooked them. God is forgiver, clement." So this verse is indicating that God has deliberately overlooked these things. God is not short on words. If he wanted us to know exactly who this individual was, what their name was, who in history this corresponds to, he would inform us, but he doesn't. Like, an interesting take is the identity of Zulkarnain. It says that they ask you about Zulkarnain, but then the Quran never explicitly identifies who is Zulkarnain. So right now there's a dispute. Is it Alexander the Great? Is it Cyrus? Is it Buddha? Is it who? Right? The Quran doesn't give us that detail because, again, it's not important. The lesson that's being depicted is what's important. That's what's in the Quran. And knowing who this individual is not pertinent for our salvation. What's pertinent for our salvation, again, is the lesson, the concepts that are being discussed. That's what God wants us to focus on. The fact that he intentionally omits this, it allows it to become a source of division for people who want to argue and bicker about these aspects. Now, another interesting example showing that the Quran is focused on concepts, on knowledge, on wisdom, rather than names, is the five salats in the Quran. Some people get fixated that the Quran only mentions the names of two salats by name, and then a third one, which is kind of a description. So for instance, in Surah 24, verse 58, it talks about the Salat al-Fajr, the dawn salat, and Salat al-Isha, the night salat. And then also we have this mention in 2238 about Salat al-Wusta, which is just translated as the middle prayer, but it doesn't indicate which one is the middle prayer. But an analysis of the Quran shows us that there's five distinct prayer times. But individuals who get fixated on the names, they miss this bigger concept. And you can look specifically in the Quran that there's five distinct prayer times. Now, without getting too much into the weeds regarding this, just really quick. So we already saw in 2458 that Salat al-Isha, Salat al-Fajr are both being mentioned, right? The dawn salat and the night salat. And then if you go to 1778, we see that this is the salat which is known as the noon salat. It says, "You shall observe the contact prayer salat when the sun declines from its highest point at noon as it moves towards sunset." So now we have three of the salats addressed. Then if you go to Surah 11, verse 114, we get the last remaining salats. So in 11:114, it says, "You shall observe the contact prayer salat at both ends of the day and during the first part of the night." And the Arabic there is Zulfin min Layl. So this is the first part of the night. This would correspond to sunset. So now the question is, what is the both ends of the day? Now we can say pretty confidently that one of the ends of the day is dawn, which is the Salat al-Fajr. And then if we say that the other end of day, it can't be sunset because it says at both ends of the day and during the first part of the night, which would be sunset. So this makes it basically afternoon. So the two ends of the day are dawn and afternoon. Now, if we want further confirmation of this, you can go to chapter 20, verse 130, and it'll tell you definitively that the definition of the ends of the day or the borders of the day is dawn and afternoon. So it reads, "Therefore, be patient in the face of their utterances, praise and glorify your Lord before sunrise and before sunset." So it's giving us two time periods, before sunrise, before sunset. "And during the night, glorify him." And then again, it says, "as well as both ends of the day, that you may be happy." Now, if you look at the Arabic for the part that says, "as well as both ends of the day," what you'll see is that the word is fa-sa-bi, not wa-sa-bi. Fa-sa-bi means like kind of so, therefore. It's actually a call back to the beginning of the verse where it's giving us this exact definition of the two ends of the day, which is before sunrise and before sunset. So this corresponds to, again, dawn and afternoon. So if we go back to 11:114, we see that these are the remaining times. When it says, "You shall observe the contact prayer salat at both ends of the day and during the night," right? So this is signifying that since Zulfin min Layl is sunset, that the two ends of the day, we have two confirmations that this is dawn and afternoon. So between this and 2458 and 1778, we have all five distinct prayer times. Now, what's interesting with this methodology of determining the five distinct prayer times is we didn't even have to use Salat al-Wusta, which is mentioned in Surah 2, verse 238, because this expression, it's very open-ended. So first, let's read the verse. It says, "You shall consistently observe the contact prayers, especially the middle prayer, and devote yourselves totally to God." So the question is, what is the middle prayer? And you'll see argumentation that the middle prayer is the noon prayer. Some people say it's sunset prayer. Some people say it's afternoon prayer. Some people say it's night prayer. There's argumentation for each of these. Now, we're able to, again, identify the five distinct prayer times, not even using this verse. That's the reason I don't say that this is a name of a salat, but it's more of a description. And I have my, you know, understanding of which one this corresponds to, but, you know, God willing, we can address this in another episode. So now that we see that the Quran, it doesn't get fixated on names and terms, it's more interested in concepts, things that, again, are universally understood. Because if I use a term, say Salat al-Wusta, that might mean different things for different people. So God, you know, identifies the five distinct prayer times, puts this in there in order for people who want to find, you know, reason to doubt, to argue, to go and pursue that, to extrapolate certain interpretations and then divide themselves among the masses. You know, ironically, despite the Quran's emphasis on substance over terminology, some individuals seek to elevate their status by testing people's religious knowledge by using, you know, obscure terms and then looking down on people when they don't understand what it is that they're communicating. You know, this behavior, it's particularly ironic considering that many of these terms deemed crucial to today's, you know, religion or assessing one's faith would have been unknown at the time of the Prophet, let alone the prophets and messengers who lived before Muhammad. And this isn't unique to Muslims. Every religion does this. They get so caught up in terms and jargon, right? And it makes them feel elevated, like, oh, they have some, you know, hidden knowledge. You know, consider Christianity, the entire Trinity doctrine. You know, if I went to Jesus 2,000 years ago and I used the term homoousius, he would have no clue what I'm talking about. Or if I said a trinity, a triune, right, a biune, he wouldn't know, like, what is this? None of his message corresponds with this. These are terminology that were fabricated, you know, hundreds of years after his death. And people now today use these as if this is core to his message. And they did the same thing to Muhammad. Look at so many of these terms they use today. I mean, this whole concept of sunnah. Like, show me in the Quran, where does it specify exactly sunnah of Muhammad? You know, that terminology does not exist. The only entity that is associated with the sunnah in the entire Quran is the sunnah of God. For example, in 48:23, it says, such is God's sunnah throughout history, and you'll find that God's sunnah is unchangeable. And this is typically associated with the past communities who failed to take heed when their messenger came to them and they were annihilated. We don't have this concept of the sunnah of Muhammad. It doesn't exist in the Quran. Or you think about all the other numerous terminology, like we constantly have these discussions with traditionalists, they come on and they just start blathering out, you know, random terms. And I wonder, I say, look, did Muhammad know what any of these terms were? Because if he didn't, then it's not pertinent for our religion. It's not pertinent for our salvation. And this is more of a bigger theme. You know, people often cling to the Arabic terms without conveying their meanings in English, which obscures the essence of the words that are core to our religion. Like if I tell someone I'm a Muslim, they have a preconceived notion of what that is. But when I don't translate this term as submitter, someone who submits to the will of God, you know, that essence is lost. Same thing with the term Islam. Islam means submission. You know, when we don't translate these terms and we use them in their Arabic form, you know, people get confused. They don't understand what the religion is about. This practice, it dilutes the significance of these terms for those unfamiliar with Arabic. Similarly, even the name Allah and his many attributes detailed in the Quran, these should all be translated because people hear the term Allah and they think we're talking about some foreign God. They don't realize, no, this is just God with a capital G, or all of God's attributes. If we don't translate these to someone and we use the Arabic term, they have no clue what we're talking about. It's important that when we communicate these terms, we communicate them in a language where everyone can understand. Again, if we get fixated on the jargon and forget what these words represent, the meanings they represent, then we're only elevating our own status and exalting ourselves and not communicating clearly with our audience. Consider that the Quran repeatedly asks readers to reflect, to comprehend, to ponder, to take heed of the verses. Yet how can anyone do that if the terms are not translated for them in a language they understand? In Surah 26, verse 198 and 199, it reads, if we revealed this to people who do not know Arabic and had him recite it in Arabic, they could not possibly believe in it. Right? It's going to sound like gibberish to them. Yeah, it might sound eloquent, might sound nice, but how are they going to be able to comprehend its verses? How are they going to be able to ponder and reflect and apply to their lives? You know, some claim that the Quran cannot be translated. Yet the following verse indicates that the Quran can and should be translated. This is because while the original language of the Quran is Arabic, the meaning of the words transcends language for those whom God wishes to guide. In Surah 41, verse 44, it reads, if we made it a non-Arabic Quran, they would have said, why did it come down in that language? And here it says, whether it is Arabic or non-Arabic, say, for those who believe it is a guide and healing. As for those who disbelieve, they will be deaf and blind to it, as if they are being addressed from far away. Someone can be a PhD in Arabic, but if they're insincere, God is going to block them from being able to understand the message. But the aspect is, there is no question that if someone doesn't understand the language, doesn't matter how eloquent your Arabic is, they're not going to be able to take heed. They're not going to be able to apply it to their life. The Quran is referenced as a message to the world. In Surah 68, verse 52, it says, it is in fact a message to the world. This indicates that the Quran must be translated. Now we know every messenger comes to preach in the tongue of their people. And in Surah 14, verse 4, we read, we did not send any messenger except to preach in the tongue of his people in order to clarify things for them. God then sends astray whomever he wills and guides whomever he wills. He is almighty, the most wise. So the fact that the messenger has to preach in the language of its people, what's interesting is we see that the Quran is referenced in the Quran as a messenger of God. In Surah 65, verse 10 and 11, it says, God has prepared for them severe retribution. Therefore, you shall reverence God, O you who possess intelligence and believe. God has sent down to you a message. Right, so it ends the verse with saying a message, and then in 65:11 it continues, a messenger who recites to you God's revelations, clearly to lead those who believe and work righteousness out of darkness into the light. Anyone who believes in God and leads a righteous life, he will admit him into gardens with flowing streams. They abide therein forever. God will generously reward him. All this informs us that the Quran must be translated. Concepts should be stated straightforwardly in a language people can understand. This is because the true value lies not in the terms, but the concepts that the Quran represents. Therefore, it's crucial to transcend the language barrier by translating words and concepts into the listener's language clearly and straightforwardly. This ensures that the profound teachings and principles of the Quran are accessible and meaningful to all, regardless of their language. Focusing on clearly communicating the concepts conveyed in the Quran will bridge the gap between knowledge and understanding. Ultimately, it's the understanding and the principles of the Quran that can transform people's lives and guide them by God's leave, and not just a mere heedless recitation of sounds without understanding. In Surah 2, verse 171, it gives us this example. It says, the example of such disbelievers is that of parrots, who repeat what they hear of sounds and calls, without understanding. Deaf, dumb, and blind, they cannot understand. When people utilize vague or complex terminology that they're familiar, they know that their audience is going to struggle to understand. It often indicates either an attempt to project intellectual superiority or to obscure the true intentions and message of what's being communicated. Clear and straightforward language is a disinfectant against the satanic schemes to obscure the truth, to try to swindle people with fancy words and eloquent speech. This is because it leaves little room for manipulation. This strategy mirrors the tactics traditionally attributed to deceptive figures who lure others with eloquent but misleading rhetoric to disguise their genuine objectives. In Surah 6, verse 112, God warns us of this. It says, we have permitted the enemies of every prophet, human and jinn devils, to inspire in each other fancy words in order to deceive. Had your Lord willed, they would not have done it. You shall disregard them and their fabrications. So realize, when individuals attempt to cover the meaning of their speech through ambiguous jargon, fancy terms that is not clearly understandable to their audience, and they fail to be straightforward, are either ignorant or malicious. Righteousness, on the other hand, is achieved by being straightforward in our speech and clear in our language so that our intentions and message are not misconstrued by the audience being addressed. We read this example in Surah 2, verse 189, says, they ask you about the phase of the moon. Say, they provide a timing device for the people and determine the time of Hajj. It is not righteous to beat around the bush. Righteousness is attained by upholding the commandments and by being straightforward. You shall observe God that you may succeed. Now, what's interesting is this verse uses a classical Arabic idiom of entering the homes through the back door. And this is equivalent to the English expression of do not beat around the bush. You have to be straightforward with people. You come in through the front door, not the back door. And this reminds me of a verse in the Bible, John 10. It says, "Very truly, I tell you, Pharisees, anyone who does not enter the sheep pen by the gate, but climbs in by some other way, is a thief and a robber. The one who enters by the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. The gatekeeper opens the gate for him, and the sheep listen to his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out." Mean that if we're communicating with someone, again, we come in through the front door, we present ourselves. We don't come in through some back channel, some other mechanism. The language we use is concise, it's precise, and it's designed for the audience we're attempting to reach. God willing, I want to start wrapping up this podcast with a few more verses. The first set is from Surah 2, verse 8 through 12. It reads, "Then there are those who say we believe in God and the last day, while they are not believers. In trying to deceive God and those who believe, they only deceive themselves without perceiving. In their minds there is a disease. Consequently, God augments their disease. They have incurred a painful retribution for their lying. When they are told, do not commit evil, they say, but we are righteous. In fact, they are evildoers, but they do not perceive." We must be incredibly conscientious about the words that come out of our mouth. When we're preaching God's message, again, to use language where the audience can understand, that we don't try to obfuscate what our message is with fancy jargon and terminology to appear to seem, you know, more educated, more knowledgeable. No, we have to speak in a language where people, God willing, can understand. And if we do that, inshallah, and we preach the right message, God willing, God is going to reward us for our striving. And God willing, going to end with one last verse. This is Surah 45, verse 23. It reads, "Have you noted the one whose God is his ego? Consequently, God sends him astray despite his knowledge, seals his hearing and his mind, and places a veil on his eyes. Who then can guide him after such a decision by God? Would you not take heed?" God willing, we're going to end there. If you guys want to get in contact, you can join us on our Discord server. The invite link is below. If you want to follow along the verses of the Quran, you can download the Quran Study app on the iOS App Store. If you don't have an iOS device, we have the QuranStudyApp.com website. And if you want notes from today's discussion, as well as other topics, you can go to Quran Talk blog website. And if you want more regular updates, you can follow me on Twitter @TalkQuran. And until next time, peace and God bless.